It is April 20th, 2012. This is Stephanie Manassas, and I am interviewing Mr. Richard Mansfield Smith in Fargo, North Dakota. All right, Mr. Smith, could you tell me a little bit about where you were born and your family that you grew up in?
I was born in Leeds, North Dakota. I grew up at least till first grade in North Dakota. I went to first and second grade in Moorhead, Minnesota. My father bought a country elevator in Doran, Minnesota, which is just south of Breckenridge. I lived there till my junior year in Breckenridge High School. My mother insisted that I commute back and forth to school because she thought maybe I should have a little bit better education than the one-room school house where they had the high school. They had three grades in three rooms. When I graduated from high school, my mother enrolled me at the University of Notre Dame. I made that work for 2.5 years. I wanted to fly. I knew I was a prime candidate for the military. So a friend of mine and I enlisted at Fort Wayne, Indiana. And in due time, I was called up to join the Cadet Corps. I made that work. I graduated in February 1943. And at that point, got in pretty active military. Do you want more about my life in Doran?
If you could tell me the day and year that you were born and tell me what year you graduated from high school, please.
I was born September 8th, 1921. And I graduated from Breckenridge High School in 1939.
Okay. So tell me, did you have brothers and sisters? And if so, how many?
I had a half-brother who was 8 years older than I am, so he wasn't around very much. My mother sent him away to school. It was her son sent him away to school. And I had a sister 8 years younger. So I was probably raised more like an only child.
And you said you graduated in which year?
1939.
Okay. So when you were in high school, did you have any thoughts about what you wanted to do when you grew older?
I didn't have any thoughts. I just knew I was going to have something to do with the elevator business because I liked hanging around in the elevator. I worked the harvest fields. I used to cooper up boxcars, which you don't know anything about. I worked very hard for my father, but I never got paid. And the day I left Breckenridge on the Empire Builder to go to South Bend, my dad was at the train to say goodbye, and he gave me a book of blank checks. Do you know what blank checks are? When I was growing up, you could get a book of blank checks on, say, the Farmers and Merchants State Bank. And then you could write in there who you wanted to pay and how much, and write out how much, and sign your name. And in my case, I would sign my father's name on the bottom. Not much paperwork in those days. And as I was getting on the train, he gave me the book of blank checks, and he said, don't abuse the privilege. The way I went.
Okay. So tell me about the boxcars. What did you do with the boxcars?
Well, before they had the tank cars that you see hundreds of them now in a string, we had wooden boxcars that had sliding doors on both sides. And the railroad furnished us, like, we call them grain doors. They were made out of rough lumber, and they were about 7 feet long. And we would throw those in the car, get in there, and nail them up on the inside, put some paper in the cracks, and crawl out and put the grain spigot in there. And if we could put 2,000 bushels of grain in a boxcar in those days, we were doing really well. The tankers now, we put 4,000 bushels in. And you don't have to do anything other than make sure the hole in the bottom is closed.
So it's much easier now.
On the other hand, to compete in the grain business today, you have to be able to load 250 cars of grain in 24 hours. So, as you drive through the country, you see a lot of great big steel tanks in some small towns. And then they take them from small towns to a bigger town where they have maybe a sub-terminal.
Okay.
Because a lot of elevators do not have the capacity to load 4,000 bushel capacity tank cars.
Okay. So you knew then at an early age that you wanted to follow in your father's footsteps.
I did.
Did you talk to your dad about it at all?
No.
It was just a given.
I was on the service before the war in Europe was over. Because of my World War II experience, I got out early to go to work for Eastern Airlines. I was in New York City when they took gasoline rationing off. It took me about 5 minutes to decide I didn't want to live in New York City. So I went down to the operations office for Eastern, had a visit with a nice man. We parted company. And before I left, I called my dad and said, I'm not happy in New York. I'm going to quit flying. Do I have a job when I get home? And he said, yes.
Okay. All right. So you said your mother registered you at Notre Dame.
Yes.
Did she talk to you about what school she wanted you to go to, or how was this decision made?
Well, my mother was my dad was a good man. He had no religion. On the other hand, all the time I was gone in the underground, he went to church every day. So when it came time to go away to school, my mother decided I needed to go to a Catholic school. And so I went to Notre Dame.
And did she choose Notre Dame for you, or?
Well, she knew I wanted to go. I followed Notre Dame football when I was a kid. Yeah.
Was that a difficult school to get into then, like it is now?
Evidently not, because I had no science and no foreign language. And I can remember the priest saying to my mother, you know, your son will have to make up these courses to graduate. And she said, oh, that'll be no problem.
He was saying that you'd have to make them up in Notre Dame to graduate.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So tell me about your Notre Dame experience.
Well, I was a dumb farm kid mixed in with a lot of like young men who had been to some good prep schools, who'd been to some good Catholic parochial schools, as I look back on it now, if I would have applied myself, I could have done really well. But I was away from home. And so you always try to find some outs. We had to be in bed by 10 o'clock. We had to get up and go to Mass every morning. Or you didn't get to stay out till 10:30 on Saturday night.
Did you go to church very much growing up as a child?
No.
Not at all?
Because we had, well, no, but we had to commute. I commuted. I was big in high school because I had a car. Wasn't every kid had a car then. In fact, I was the only kid in high school that had a car. And so my mother made arrangements with the local priest in Breckenridge that when I got done with football practice or basketball practice or baseball or track or something, I would stop and he would inform me of the niceties of the Catholic Church so that I could become confirmed.
Okay. All right. So in Notre Dame, you went to Mass every morning. What did you study at Notre Dame?
I'm ashamed to tell you that. The priest told my mother that I should be in economics and philosophy, and I should have been in business.
But you were in economics and philosophy?
I was.
Did you like it?
Not particularly. There's a lot of philosophy courses that the average person doesn't ever hear about that I didn't find very interesting, and nobody else did either except the priest or the instructor. The economics part I liked really much. But I should have been in business, and I got the economics on the side.
Okay. Did you realize that much later when you had your own business, or in school did you know you were in the wrong major?
After I was out of school and was married and looked around and said I don't really find much use of philosophy dealing with farm clientele.
Okay. Why did you decide to leave the university and enlist in the military?
Oh, I was a prime candidate. I knew I was going to have to go.
Why were you a prime candidate?
Well, I was about 6'1", 6'1 and a half, 175, 180 pounds. I had all my fingers and toes. My head obviously was working pretty well, and I'd always wanted to fly, and I didn't really want to have them give me a rifle and start walking through the mud.
So you wanted to be able to have some control over your destiny by enlisting?
As much as I could.
Did you enlist in, now first of all, did you enlist in the Air Force, or where did you enlist?
There was no Air Force then.
There was no Air Force then.
It was the United States Army Air Corps.
Army Air Corps, that's right. So was there an enlistment office in the town where Notre Dame was?
No. We hitchhiked about 90 miles away to Fort Wayne, Indiana.
Who did you hitchhike with?
One of my classmates.
Okay. Tell me about what happened after you went to the Army Air Corps and enlisted.
They sent me home and said, you'll get orders. So I got orders to go down to Kelly Field in San Antonio, Texas. And they started making a soldier and a gentleman out of me.
Okay. How long were you in boot camp for?
I'd say 12 weeks.
And then what kind of training did they send you to?
Well, then I went to primary training in Sikeston, Missouri, and learned to fly.
How long was that?
That also was 12 weeks.
Any memorable experiences from your flight training?
my instructor let me solo before he should have.
Tell me more.
Not much to say. He just said to me one day, he said, Mr. Smith, would you like to go by yourself? And I said, yeah. So he said, fly around the pattern and land, taxi back and talk to me. If everything's going good, you'll do that three times. And when we were taxiing back up to the ramp, he said to me, how much time do you have, Mr. Smith? I said, just a little bit over 7 hours. God, he said, don't tell anybody. They'll take my job away from me. I'm not supposed to solo anybody until I've got 8 hours or more.
Do you think that decision was based on the fact that he thought you had a lot of potential?
Well, I think that he decided I could fly.
Okay. Tell me about the first time you were out on your own flying.
Well, some people tell you that we had some guys that when they got up there, they couldn't go around in the pattern. They'd see that empty hole up there where the instructor was supposed to be. And they'd fly and fly around until they ran out of gas. Then they'd try to land and crash land. To me, I was very confident that I could fly. I did what he told me to do.
Okay.
I didn't have any problem.
All right. And that was in Sykeston, you said? Then what happened after Sykeston?
Enid, Oklahoma, for basic.
Okay.
Bigger airplane, bigger engine.
Tell me more.
About the same kind of stuff. Shoot landings, fly a little cross country, fly some at night. Be nice to your instructor so he didn't wash you out. I had a really good instructor there. He would get a hold of me every once in a while and he'd say, Mr. Smith, let you and I go check the weather. And we'd go up and fly in the cumulus clouds, which is, it's really fun. And so that period of time went by. Then I went to advanced flying school, to an engine, Pampa, Texas. We were the first group in there, so we spent some time with razor blades taking the paint off from the windows. Pampa, Texas. Not too much there.
What was it like?
Well, we're just a little old cow town up in North Texas.
Okay. How long were you in Pampas, Texas? Pampa,
12
Texas.
Weeks.
12 weeks. So this was your fourth session?
Third.
Your third of 12
Primary,
weeks.
Primary, basic, and advanced.
Primary, basic, and advanced.
And then I got my second lieutenant's bars and my silver wings. And then I was sent to Boise, Idaho. How much do you really want here?
You tell me whatever you want, Mr. Smith.
You don't want any of my personal life, do you?
Well, if you have some fun story about your personal life in the military and you want to share it, I'd love to hear it. If you fell in love with a woman in Boise, I want to know, because I want to know if you're communicating with her overseas.
There was a young lady that I had dated from my second or third day in high school through college and through the junior prom at Notre Dame. She wanted to get married. And she somehow or another got to Pampa, Texas during wartime. And she wanted to get married. She wanted to get married. And and I would say, why do we want to get married? The first thing that's going to happen, I'm going to be shipped overseas, and you're going to have a little bundle of joy that may be crying all the time, pitched from pillar to post. She was after me and after me and after me. I finally said, oh, hell. When I get to my first duty station, which eventually was Boise, I said, I'll find out how much trouble it is to get married, and I'll be in touch. Well, I was in Boise 2 weeks, and I got a Dear John letter from my girlfriend telling me she just married another young military man in Denver, Colorado. And I was madder than hell for about 15 minutes. And then I finally said to myself, what the hell? You're free. You're on your own. You have no more or any encumbrances. There were a lot of available females at every, I shouldn't say every Army post, but at every flying field. There was something about a pair of wings that the girls liked. And you knew you weren't going to be there very long, and they knew you weren't going to be there very long. So I got sent around from. I was in Boise, Idaho, and one day I went down to the duty board and found out I was going to fly that night. And so I went down, and there was an instructor pilot in the right seat, so-called the pilot in the left seat. We started in, and the young man that was the pilot was not having a very good night. And on his third landing and go-around, the instructor pilot said to me, Mister, have you ever flown this airplane? I said, no, sir. It's the first time I've been in one. Well, he said, get in the seat. It can't be any worse than it is. I got really lucky. I shot 3 nice square patterns and nice landings. We are on our way up to the ramp because our time was over. And he looked at me and he says, they've got the wrong man flying this airplane. And from that minute on, I had my own crew. That's as much instruction as I got in flying a B-17.
Okay, now tell me a little bit more. You mean he said we've got the wrong man flying this airplane, that was the other pilot? Or no, what do you mean?
Well, he said, I should be flying the airplane, not the other guy.
Got it. So he switched.
So I never saw the other guy again.
Okay.
I don't know what they did. They may have moved him to another base to make him a co-pilot or what. I don't know.
Okay.
You found friends and you lost friends just like this in the service. Some of them were in crashes. Some of them got transferred. There were no long-standing friendships.
How did you deal with that?
Well, I just went where I went where they told me to go and did what they told me to do.
Okay.
There was one thing that really ticked me off, however. We were told if we got caught flying formation that we would get washed out. And nobody at that point wanted to get washed out. We were all gung-ho. So two other guys and I decided on 4th of July to defy some formation, and we went down over Coeur d'Alene Lake, kind of low, and blew over a few sailboats, and kept on going, and then we all spread out. When I got to my duty station in England, and had come back from my first mission, the squadron commander said to me, "Lieutenant, you don't fly very good formation." Well, he's a major, I'm a second lieutenant. There's no way I'm going to make an excuse. So I didn't get off on a very good start there. I eventually caught up and found out how it was supposed to go. So anyway, then we just traveled around Western United States from one Army Air Corps base to another. And eventually we wound up in Grand Island, Nebraska. They gave us a brand new B-17. Told us to get ready to go overseas, get your shots. So one morning they sent us off to Bangor, Maine, to Goose Bay, Labrador, over to Reykjavik, down into Prestwick. We were so damn smart that we had stowed all of our oxygen gear on the bomb. We took all of our gear with us in the airplane, in the bomb bay. So if we'd hit, and we were on instruments all the way. So very uneventful.
Okay, so you were up in Maine, and then from Maine, where did you go?
Goose Bay, Labrador.
Oh, Labrador, I didn't get that. Okay, so Goose Bay, Labrador, how long were you in Labrador?
Just overnight to fill up with gas.
Okay.
Get something to eat. When we stopped at Reykjavik, there was a GI in a Jeep. He says, "I'll give you $100 for every bottle of whiskey you got on board." We were so damn dumb we didn't have one. We didn't take a camera with us.
This is Reykjavik in Greenland?
No.
Or no?
Iceland.
Iceland, okay. I knew
Reykjavik,
it was Greenland, Iceland. Or Iceland. So you went to Iceland. How long were you in Iceland?
Overnight.
Just overnight, and then what happened?
We flew to Prestwick, Scotland.
Okay, got it.
Then they took the airplane away from us. I had stood across the street from the Johnny Walker's distillery and paid $20 for a bottle of Johnny Walker Scotch whiskey. I didn't think that was very nice of them, but then they put us on the train and we went down south of London. We were there for a few days. And one of my enlisted men came and said, "Hey boss, they're breaking up the crew. They're sending us all over." I said, "Okay." So I went down to the chief, the master sergeant. I said, "Have you got a typewriter?" He said, "Yes." I said, "Have you got some order forms that are blank?" He said, "Yes." I said, "Well, can I use your typewriter and give me a few forms?" He said, "What are you going to do?" I said, "I'm going to send my crew to the 95th Bomb Group." He said, "You can't do that." And I said to him, "Do you care where we go?" "Hell no, I don't care." I said, "Give me the paper, give me the typewriter." So we all wound up at the 95th. I signed the thing on the bottom. There's a lot of funny things you could do during the war because nobody really did give a damn.
Tell me more what you mean by that.
Well, just like that. Nobody checked to see who had signed the orders, who had moved Dick Smith one place and elbow or another. Nobody looked.
There was not.
All they looked up at the top. Lieutenant Richard M. Smith, 0672007, report on or before Horam, England.
So you basically determined where your group went to?
Not basically, I did determine.
You did determine. And nobody was the wiser.
Nobody ever said a word.
That's kind of strange.
A lot of strange things happened in the war.
Was there just not the level of accountability? They weren't keeping track of things very well?
Everybody was too busy. They'd look at the top to see that Lieutenant William Boer was where he was supposed to be. They never looked at the bottom, who signed the order.
So why did you want to go to the 95th Squadron?
That's where I was sent. I didn't know the 95th from the 100th or the 303 or whatever. That was just where they were sending me. And so I made the determination that that's where I was going to send the rest of the crew.
Okay. And then where were you sent for the 95th Squadron?
Horam, England. It was a crossroads out in East Anglia. Do you know England?
I've only been to London before.
Well, south of London, there's quite a big flat area called East Anglia. And that's where all of the bomber bases were. You could look down anytime and see four or five runways. And at Horam, there was a church and an ancient house. And the 95th bomb.
When you say ancient house, what do you mean by
old,
that?
Old house.
Okay.
Yeah. Maybe back from the 1500s.
Okay. So how long were you based out of Horam?
Till I got shot down.
Okay. So tell me about the different missions you were on.
Well, the first mission we went on was to Bremen. And we were tooling along, and it was a beautiful day, not a cloud in the sky. And all of a sudden I could see this great big thunderhead up in front of us. And I said to my co-pilot, he and I got along really well. We became fast friends. Long after the war. And I said, for God's sakes, Bill, I said, there's a great big thunderhead here, and there's another thing in the sky. We kept going along, and all of a sudden I saw a big red flash. And I thought, holy, we're going to have to fly through that crap. Which we did. I went to Bremen three times. I went to Norway once, over the North Sea. I went up to the free city of Danzig once, Marienburg.
And where was Bremen?
Bremen was a major, major seaport on the North Sea.
Okay.
Major. And then there was a couple other trips in between. The sad part of it really was is that they'd get us up at 3 o'clock in the morning, give us breakfast, take us to briefing, tell us where we were going to go and how we were going to get there, get in the airplane, take off with a full bomb load and a full gas load, get up to altitude 28, 29, 30,000 feet, get a message over the radio. The mission has been scrubbed. So there we were. Had gone to all the effort. And takeoffs, a lot of times, were just as bad as flying through the flak. I mean, the airplane was overloaded. You lose an engine on take-in and take-off, and that's the end of the road.
How often did you see that happen to other guys? Twice?
I was waiting my... Today. If you don't have the whole runway, they won't let you go. In those days, we fed from two lines coming in. And so this guy would go, and then this guy on this edge of the runway, 30 seconds later, he'd go. Then 30 seconds later, I'd go. So there was a minute for the prop wash to dissipate a little bit. And so I'm waiting to pull in line, and a guy from the other side pulled in front of me. He was out of place. He missed something and was trying to make up. He got off down the end of the runway and he racked his airplane up to try to catch up and stalled. Hell, there wasn't enough left to put in the back end of a pickup. We flew low and slow when we finally got off the ground.
Because there was so much weight on the airplane?
No, I wanted to build up some airspeed. I wanted to get my conscious nerve back before I started my procedure turn and climb. We would climb on a prescribed route, triangular, at 500 feet a minute. In total overcast. Have you ever been sitting in an airplane and all of a sudden you hear it go, You know you just missed somebody by about 5 seconds. You just went through his prop wash.
Seriously?
Seriously. That wakes you up, too.
So prop wash means kind of the wind coming off of his airplane?
Wind coming off from the engines, off from the propellers. The prop wash, propeller wash.
So how did it feel to be flying when you were flying?
Well, most of the time, I guess I should say it's hard work. My co-pilot and I decided at 20 minutes. We flew tight formation. I'd fly for 20 minutes, and then he'd fly for 20 minutes. And I'd fly for 20 minutes, and he'd fly for 20 minutes. Then on the way home, the formation would spread out a little bit, and then you didn't have to be quite so precise. But if you were where there were any chance of German fighters, you had to stay tucked up real tight, or they'd come right through the formation and kind of disrupt it.
Okay. So how many missions had you flown to France before you got shot down?
To France? Just one.
The one that you got shot down in?
No, that was Ludwigshafen. We got shot down. We lost an engine over Ludwigshafen. Couldn't stay up with the group. We got into France, north of Paris. Got jumped by some German fighters, and it took them maybe 5 minutes to shoot the airplane down.
To shoot your airplane down. Okay. And you were over where?
North of Paris. 50 miles about.
Okay. Tell me what happened when you got shot down.
Well, the airplane basically became unflyable. You know what the stick is on an airplane? That's the thing that goes back and forth like this to make it go up and down. But the airplane was shot up in the tail, so it wanted to keep climbing, and I had both feet up on the stick to hold it so the guys in the back would have what could have been, what should have been, when what did happen was easy for them to get out the back door in the parachutes. Three of them were hit pretty hard. And the ball turret gunner was hit. And the co-pilot and myself, we were the last two out.
So the other four guys got hit in the airplane?
Yes.
They were killed?
No. One of them landed in shock, and a German and a French surgeon just happened to come along, and he took a look at the guy, and the Germans did not give the French any kind of medicine. And he put a slit in the guy and took out a kidney, sewed him back up. Then they hauled him off to the hospital. And my little guy over there, he just died a couple of days ago. He got shot up pretty bad, was in the same hospital. There was a German orderly sentry. And every day he'd come to see Tony and he'd say, "Tony, your friend isn't going to make it." Then he'd go up to Bob Adams and he'd say, "Bob, your friend isn't going to make it today." Well, they all did eventually make it.
Okay, I guess I'm not quite clear, Mr. Smith. So you're saying all of the guys of your crew bailed out alive?
Oh, yeah.
They all bailed out alive. Okay, and where did you land?
Where did I land?
Yes.
I landed a little town about 25 miles north of Saint-Just. It was township or county or whatever they call them in France.
And so did you land in a field or where did you land?
Oh, yeah, I landed in the field where there was an old guy, an old Frenchman plowing with a team of oxen and a wooden plow.
Then what happened?
I landed right close to him. And I took off my flying boots. I took off my Mae West vest. You know what a Mae West vest is? That's a vest that you wear, and you can pull a couple of strings here, and it inflates. It'll keep you afloat. And so then I was down to my flying suit, under which I had a A2 leather jacket. And I think, as I recall, I think the old guy was scared spitless, and he pointed one way. He said, "Aliman," pointed the other way, and he said, "Comrade." And he pointed up towards some woods. Well, I didn't know what Aliman meant at that time. It's French for German. But I knew comrade. So I took off in the dead run for up in the tree.
Without your boots on?
I had my regular, what would I say? Well, my regular Oxfords on. And they fit tight enough so that when I hit the straps in the parachute, the boots didn't come off or the shoes didn't come off. A lot of guys, when they bailed out, they had electric suits, and so they didn't have any shoes. All they had was flying boots. And when they bailed out with just flying boots, they flipped right off. Fortunately, I didn't have to go through that.
So you had boots over your shoes.
Yeah, big, heavy. Big sheepskin lined over boots.
Okay.
Big overshoes, over boots.
So you had taken those off, you took off your vest, and then you went running
towards... I laid my parachute down in the furrow, indicated for the Frenchman to plow it under. 5 days later, I was in a house. A couple of young girls came in, were pointing to their dress. Somebody in their family had retrieved the parachute, taken it apart, dyed it, made skirts out of it for them. Material was very, very scarce for any of the occupied. Well, even Germany, they didn't have anything.
Okay, so you landed in the field. The man pointed towards the woods and said, "Comrade." And tell me what happened from there.
Well, I went in the woods quite a long ways. It was a pretty big forest. And then I did a right turn, and I went quite a ways. And then I kind of doubled back, come to the edge of the woods again to see what I could see from a secluded spot. And I was listening. I could hear motorcycles, so I knew that the Germans were looking for us. And I could... In the pre-war years, the French had no fences. They had hedgerows that divided up their fields. And so I went back into the woods, and I kept going away from where I had landed to where I thought I was past the hedgerow. So I cautiously left the woods into the hedgerow, and I was walking along the far side of the hedgerow, and I saw a nice little opening there where obviously some animals, deer or something, had made a nest. And so I said to myself, well, I'll just sit here and wait. If they find me, if somebody has seen me and finds me, here I am. If not, I'll wait till deep dark. So during the afternoon, I could hear a train or trains down in front of me. And I thought, well, when it gets really, really dark, I'll head down that way, and I'll catch the first train, whichever way it's going. One of the things, I was an early evader, really. I was 336, and there were eventually 2,000. So I was kind of a pathfinder. Well, my crew was pathfinders.
What do you mean by you were pathfinder of what?
Of escape.
Okay.
Of what to do, what not to do. And I guess the simplest thing I did was I did what they told me to do. And so I'm sitting here and I'm about ready to get out and start going toward the little village to catch a train. And three young men showed up, each had a .45 automatic. And one of them had a sack over his shoulder. Well, he dumped the sack, and I became a Frenchman right there. I never saw my GI clothes again. The clothes they gave me were lousy, so I was lousy for over a month going through. I've often felt sorry for the people that put me up because I must have left their beds with whatever I had. I could feel them crawling around on me. Oh, yeah. So, they walked me down to the little town to the gendarme's office, and I could hear him deciding my fate in French. Well, there was a bounty for every airman that the French would turn in. So I, you know, apprehensive. Well, the first thing I know, they put me in the trunk of a little tiny, you know how little the French cars were? They stuffed me in the trunk of one of those cars. And I was in there for, I don't know, a half hour, 45 minutes. And then they opened up the door and I got out. And they led me into a farmhouse. And there was my radio operator and my co-pilot. And the first thing, one of the young men could speak a little English, and he told us in fractured English that half the house was pro-German, and the half the house we were in was pro-Allies or pro-French. So be very quiet. So they were sitting around, and I saw they had a liter, I guess, of some brown liquid. And the guy said to me, you know, would you like a drink? And I said, yeah. So he gave me a glass and he started to pour. And I can still remember he had a kind of a funny look on his face because I didn't want to make a pig out of myself, but I wanted quite a bit. And I had the glass about half full. I took a drink of that stuff. I couldn't talk for half an hour. It was 190 proof Calvados. My first experience with Calvados. So then anyway, we had to be very quiet. We slept on the floor. The next morning they fed us. They fed us again a little bit at noon. And then at deep dusk, they put the three of us in another car and took us down into a good-sized town. Put us into an abandoned house. That had no plumbing. Had beds, but no plumbing. Told us not to go outside and don't stand in front of the windows. By this time, a man by the name of Captain Jacques had got involved, and he could speak pretty good English. He was the leader of that section of the underground, of the resistance. So, every day, a really good-looking young girl, probably 19 or 20, would come with breakfast or dinner, supper. And every day, my radio operator was Italian, so he could do a little bit of French or Italian French or something. And so we would get to talking to her. And one day after she'd been maybe about 10 days, she came and she was kind of crying. And my radio officer, what's the matter? She says, I can't come to see you anymore. He said, why not? What have we done? She says, my husband, who was Captain Jacques, and he was a good 40 years older than she was, says I'm spending too much time here. So he won't let me come here. So then we were on kind of thin rations for a while, and then pretty soon a man came and said, if you've got anything, pick it up because you're moving. So we moved into a little one-bedroom house, kind of on the outskirts of town. where there was a husband and a wife and a brand new baby. And that lady could cook. She had a rabbit hutch in the backyard. We ate a lot of lopping stew. That's French for rabbit. In years to come, I would kid the little girl who now is 20, 25 years old. I'd kid her about when she was brand new, I'd change her shorts for her. And we took turns. They wouldn't sleep on the bed. So we took turns sleeping on the bed. Two in the bed and one on the floor. We'd keep rotating. And our host and hostess and the little baby would go out back in the barn and sleep in the hay. And he worked at the paint factory. And one time in 1969, my wife brought Paul and Yvonne over to the States, to Orlando, to one of our reunions. Showed them a very nice time. So anyway, another morning, we'd been probably 2 weeks in the Saint-Just area, said, well, today you're going to Paris. So here comes a great big old diameter Benz. I thought, where in the hell did they find that thing? And how do they have enough gas to make it go? But anyway, he took us into Paris, and he couldn't find where we were supposed to go. He finally stopped and made a telephone call, found out where we were supposed to go. He dropped us off in a little tiny apartment with an English lady who had stayed 2 days too long in France and was interned. So we had tea, and she said, I suppose you gentlemen can figure out that I just can't keep four of you here. And we said, well, yeah, pretty tight.
This is the English lady?
Yes.
In Paris?
In Paris. So she made a telephone call, and in about a half an hour, she said, you go out the door and turn right. And we were right by the Arc of Triumph, maybe two blocks away. And she said, you look kitty corner across the street, and you'll see a man there with a newspaper rolled up in his side pocket of his coat. And you follow him. You stay on one side of the road, and you stay on the other. So we're walking down the Champs-Élysées, bumping shoulders with the German soldiers and their friendly girlfriends. And pretty soon we saw him cross the street and go through a door. So we went right through the door also. And we were in the Canadian Pacific Railroad building. We were on the fifth floor, my radio operator and I. The ball turret gunner couldn't walk very good. The co-pilot was still a little fretty. So they stayed with the French, with the English lady. Al and I went downtown, across the street from the Grand Hotel and down from the Opera House. And we were having supper that night, came a rap on the door.
No, I'm sorry, you went into the Canadian Pacific building, and then what happened from there?
We were taken up on the fifth floor.
And then where did you go?
Came back down to the living quarters. The people we were staying with had living quarters on the first floor.
Of the Canadian Pacific Railway, okay. This was like a new family now that you're going to stay from the English women's house,
yes.
Okay?
Yes. You never exchanged names.
Okay.
The only reason I know the Beggs is Yvonne said to me, she said, you write your name and address in the United States. And if we live through this, we'll contact you. Nobody would give us their names or where they live. So anyway, we're down around a nice table.
Now, what I don't understand is, were you having dinner on the main floor of this building, or you went out for dinner?
Oh, no. Never went out.
That's what I was didn't understand. Okay, so you're having dinner on the main floor of the Canadian Pacific building where this couple lives. Okay, and you're having dinner.
There was a rap on the door, and in walked a German soldier. Well, fortunately, neither Al nor myself paid any attention. I mean, we didn't turn to look at him or anything. We could see. And he had real coffee beans that he was bringing to have our madam. She had a coffee grinder, and she'd grind coffee beans for his three officers on the third floor. So he came every other night. And he finally asked who we were. And we were relatives from the South in Paris for a few days, vacation. We ate and drank there very, very well. This lady was getting money from the underground, from the resistance. And twice a week she would go out in the country. We had real butter, we had real cheese, we had good meat, we had white bread. Wine was plentiful. And that maybe something else. So then, one of them, either the man or the woman, must have been part Jewish or something. Because after the first night, every night, we had Jewish people for dinner. And they had the Tsar David on. And they ate very well with us. And there was a lot of chatter. It was very lighthearted. And one day, one of the ladies, Jewish ladies, I think had one glass too much wine, and the German soldier showed up, and she started giving, you could tell by the tone, that she was giving him a hard time about something. And I said to myself, what the hell is she doing? Let him get his coffee beans ground and get out of here. No, she was after him. So after he'd gone for a while, I said, the mistress of the house, Monsieur. I said, what's that all about? Well, he said, she was telling him that when the American airmen came, they were going to put the run on the Germans and run them right back to Germany. And he was telling her he could care less, he'd sooner be home anyway.
But he didn't know she was Jewish?
Oh, yeah, she had a big Star David on her. Oh, everybody did.
But how in the world were they there in front of Germans being Jewish and not being shipped off?
Well, it just hadn't been their turn yet. Or maybe they had some... You see, the Germans didn't ship all the Jews out. They just shipped out the ones that they couldn't use. For something other. The one of them might have been a laboratory technician that the Germans needed her to work to do something. No, they didn't send all the Jews. They sent almost all of them. But any of the Jews that could help them, they left them.
So he said he would just as soon be home, so he didn't care.
Yeah, right.
And he never realized that you guys look different than the French?
Well, we were, but by this time we had different clothes. And so we were just tourists that had come up. Even as bad as it was, you could make arrangements to take a train if you dared to get on the train, because even then, there was no fighter escort for us, but there were low-level sorties of pea shooters shooting up trains. And so it was always hit and miss. You might get a train that went through just fine. You might get one that was blown up.
And who were blowing up the trains?
Not me. I have friends that did stayed with the French underground and went out with them to do sabotage work, but not me and not my radio operator, and not the other two either. Then one morning a delightful young lady came, and she shook me and said, "Mr. Smith, you're going today. Get dressed." While I was getting dressed, she was trying to talk my radio operator into staying on and operating the radio for the resistance. And he said, "No, no thanks." So anyway, she took me on the subway down to the train station. Then I got some papers. I never got any money, but I got some papers. I had a discharge from the French Army. I had papers that allowed me to get up into the coastal area. I was a geologist up on the coastal area to check the footings and the foundations for the defense that the Germans were putting up. I had papers to go to work to Germany in 6 months.
And what was your name?
I don't remember.
So they gave you French papers.
We had a flood in Breckenridge one weekend, and all my high school colleagues and military stuff went to the dump. So we don't talk about that very much. Anyway, I rode the train, and just like our trains, they had MPs on them. So every time the MPs would come down the aisle, you just reach in your pocket and hold up your papers. You'd look out of the corner of your eye, and when they get done with them, when they get ready to hand them back, put your hand up there and take the papers and put them back in your pocket. The guy said, "I hope you can tell French upside down or right side up, because you're going to get a newspaper." I was under strict orders not to talk to anybody or not to do anything or take anything. I was offered wine. I was offered bread and cheese. I was offered bread and sausage.
And you just shook your head no?
I didn't do anything. I was a deaf mute.
And so you were on the train from Paris going up to where?
Saint-Brieuc, all day long.
Okay, that's up on the coast, on the Normandy coast?
Yeah, in the Brest Peninsula.
Okay.
Then I got in on a little narrow gauge train.
Now, wait a minute, was your radio operator with you as well?
No, no. He came the next day.
Okay, so you're by yourself.
Yep.
How were you feeling on the plane, on the airplane, on the train? How were you feeling?
Well, I suppose the simplest thing to say, I was lonesome. You know, it's difficult to sit and sit and sit and not say anything or do anything or go anywhere or, you know, whatever.
I would think that it would be very terrifying also.
Well, I guess my approach was, if they catch me, they catch me. If they don't, they don't. The thing that really bothered us is Captain Jacques back out at San Jose. He'd taken our dog tags. So I was with nothing to prove that I was an American soldier.
So what were you most worried about might happen?
If I got caught, intense interrogation, because they'd want to know who helped me. That's why nobody would give you their names. We did know, we had to know where we were in Paris. And, you know, there were no summary courts there. If a Frenchman or a French family was caught helping an American airman, they shot the whole works, didn't pay any attention. There was no hearings. They just took them out in the backyard and shot them and left them there for their neighbors to bury. It was not nice. So then I got on a little narrow gauge train, and I'd been told in Paris that at some point a young lady with a knee-length leather coat and knee-length rubber boots will walk down the aisle of the train. You get up and follow her. Five other guys got up. None of us knew each other. So we followed her to her home.
Now, this is at the end of the train line?
Oh, no, the narrow gauge went on. It was just a stop that we made at a little town called Plua. Was just a little ways from the coast.
Okay, so...
And the German work trains went back and forth every day. And we were going to be there at a maximum of 3 days. Either we were gone with a British gunboat, or we were going to start walking to the Pyrenees.
So you got up and five other guys got up at the same time. Were you terrified when you saw that, or you were okay?
I was very surprised. Now, I had a black felt hat and a long black coat. And when we got to this lady's house where we were all somewhat relaxed and laughing, they all thought that I was a Gestapo agent walking around the square looking for them. So they were, as it turned out, more apprehensive than I was.
So you followed her to her house. How old was this woman?
18, 19.
Young?
Yes.
It was her parents' house that she took you to?
Her mother's.
Her mother's. It was just her and her mother in the house?
Yeah.
Okay, then what happened?
We took turns. We didn't take turns. We slept on the floor.
Okay.
You know, I can't remember being up there what we had to eat. It couldn't have been very much. Probably some bread and milk or something. I don't know. It was on the third day that we finally got word that the British were coming for us. Otherwise, we'd have been walking.
To the Pyrenees?
Yes.
And then what would have happened if you walked to the Pyrenees?
Well, hopefully you'd get a hold of a Basque guide. The biggest escape route was across the Pyrenees. The train from Paris down to
Toulouse?
No, Toulouse is in the wrong way. That's
Perpignan.
That's east of the Pyrenees.
To Perpignan? You went down to Perpignan?
That sounds kind of familiar.
Perpignan is down
by the Pyrenees. There were two or three jumping off places.
Okay.
But I didn't have to do that. The British came in with their rowboats. They had a lot of clothes, a lot of medicine, but no money. And the guy, the French, the Allies were paying 15,000 real French francs for every evader that they got out back to England. And so they sent the boats back without any evaders in it to get some money to bring it back. And so I wound up, well, I was cold. I wound up with ore, helping get the boat back to the mothership as quick as possible. They had it figured out so close that they did not use hemp rope for the anchor. It was hair ropes. So it just would take one snap of the hatchet and cut the rope, and they'd be loose. There was a German gunk. The bay was like this. We were here. German gunning placement up here.
A German what?
Gunning placement.
Okay.
So they had to proceed. They would only come 3 days during the month. I don't know whether you know it or not, but it's only 3 days in the month that the moon is down, that the moon never comes up. And so they wouldn't come if there was even a sliver of the moon.
So you're saying that when the boat came the first time, they didn't have any money to pay, so they had to go back to the ship?
To get the money.
And you had to wait on the shore?
We did.
How far was this young 18-year-old woman's house and her mother's from the coast?
Two and a half miles.
And did you walk from the house to the coast?
Oh, yeah. They took us through barnyards and pigsties and anything to... The Germans patrolled with dogs. Anything to kill any kind of a scent on the trip.
And so you were walking through people's properties who had given them permission to have you walk through? Or who knows?
Who knows? I don't think anybody asked for permission.
So they would walk through barns and they walk through pigsties and stuff so that you would pick up animal scent to throw off the dogs?
Yes.
And this was at night?
Oh, yes.
So you left the house at what time at night did you leave the house approximately?
Well, it's now February 1st or 2nd.
Of 1944?
40, yeah.
Okay.
So I would imagine that the nights were long and the days were short, so we may have left this lady's house at 8:30, 9 o'clock to walk down to the beach. We walked down a very steep cliff. Very steep.
And was the radio operator with you?
Yeah. At this point, he was. And so was the ball turret gunner. When we were helping him, because he was ambulatory, but not really good.
What was wrong with him?
Well, he got shot through the top.
Okay.
So we got on the ship. We got some hot bean soup. The boat started going in. Back to England. Out of the 25 people that they picked up, there were only two of us that didn't get sick. That was my co-pilot and myself. And if you can imagine, tiers, three bunks in a tier, with the wash tub going back and forth as the ship was going up and down. You're sick to your stomach and you're trying to hit the wash tub going by, a lot of times you didn't make it.
So a lot of you were throwing up the whole trip?
Yes.
All over the place?
Yes.
And there were 25 men that they picked up off the shore?
Yes.
Just in that one point or in other parts along the coast?
No, just Pula.
Just Pula. How do you spell Pula?
P-L-O-U-G-H-A.
P-O-L-U-G-H-A. So five of them came from this woman's house where you were.
Well, they had them stashed all over.
And were they all Americans or were some of them Brits?
No, there was one Russian.
Okay.
One Russian tank commander and one German resistance worker that had, between he and the German, they had escaped from a concentration camp. And then there was a young man from Rhodesia that I got to talk to, really nice. When I was in Paris, my guy took Al and I into the German officers' quarters. And he said, if you see anything here you want, just pick it up. They got so much crap here, they don't know what they want to do. So I picked up a big black and white Meerschaum pipe for my dad, and I carried that damn thing with me all the way through till they took us off the boat in England to feed us, and then they put us in British Army uniforms, and some dirty SOB stole my pipe.
Did you have it back in your bunk, or where was it?
Well, at this point, I still had my big black coat, and by this time we got off from the boat to get onto a train. And I left it on the train to go get something to eat and then get different clothes. So, in a few days I'm back to the 95th. A few days I'm back in the U.S. A few days I'm flying guns.
So that put you back into the Army Air Corps?
I was never out of it.
So in other words, after you got back to England, you came back to the United States, they did not allow you to go home.
They would not allow us to go back on enemy operations for fear if we'd get shot down again. The Germans had planned out how we got off the first time. So you couldn't go back again.
So where did they put you?
I'd been at the Repo Depot in Atlantic City, New Jersey. And there was really nothing wrong with me. So I went down to the first sergeant. I said, why are you sending guys like me today? He said, we're sending them to you to Texas. I said, you know, I don't feel very good. I can't sleep. I'm having bad dreams. Oh, so that's nothing. They'll send you down to Lake Lure, North Carolina for a couple of weeks. There was nothing wrong with me. I just didn't want to go to Texas. So I got back to Atlantic City, and I went down to see the man. I said, where are you sending people like me today? He said, Fort Myers, Florida. I said, okay, I'm ready to go. You can beat the system if you try.
You could.
Yes. Well, what else do you want to know?
Okay, well, I have a few.
Oh, that's early.
Okay, I have a few questions for you. So, you got out of France in February of 1944?
Yes.
What day in February did you leave France?
I don't know.
And what day did you get shot down?
December 30th, 1943. 43 was a big year for me. I graduated from flying school. I became an officer and a gentleman. I got a Dear John letter. I learned to fly B-17s. I flew a B-17 almost always on instruments to England. I made a few missions. I got shot down on December 30th. 43 was a big year.
Wow, it was. So you were in the underground for about a month and a handful of days.
Yes.
What was your most strong impression the whole time? What surprised you the most or struck you the most?
I guess I would have to say the thing that I was most happy with is that what the French would do for us. The worst day I ever had was the day that I had to give up my dog tags. Because from then on, I was really vulnerable.
And Captain Jacques was the one that took your dog tags?
Yes. And I've been back to see his wife a few times. I've been back a few times to see them all. But I've been back to see his wife a couple times, too. And she doesn't know what happened to him.
What was your rank when you left the military?
Oh, well, that's interesting, Tori, too. When I got back off to Horn, when a crew got shot down, everybody kind of divided up their stuff. I mean, like I lost all my underwear, all my dress uniforms, shoes. Enlisted men the same way. Then there was an honor code that if you got back, you just posted your name on the bulletin board and said, Lieutenant Smith is back, I'd like my stuff back. And to the best of my knowledge, the only thing I ever lost is one guy took, I had a nice chronograph that my parents had given me.
I'm sorry, a what?
A chronograph wristwatch.
Okay.
Some buttons on it. And he had traded me a Bulova perpetual, but didn't have a real good band on it. That's another story. But anyway, so the commanding officer heard, obviously, that I was back, and he sent word for me to come to his office. He would like to talk to me. So we talked a while, and he said, and I told him what had happened right up to the time that I bailed out. And then he said, well, Lieutenant, what happened to you when you hit the ground? I said, well, I'm very sorry, but I took a pledge of for 50 years. I would not tell anybody what happened to me on the ground. Oh, he says, you can tell me. I said, I'm sorry. But they told me I couldn't tell anybody.
And this is the pledge that you made to the French Resistance?
No. This is to the, to the French Resistance, but through the American intelligence. See, I got debriefed. We all got debriefed when we went back. What did you do? Who did you see? Where did you go? So, the American intelligence knew exactly where I'd been and what I had done and who had helped me, but I couldn't tell anybody else.
Well, so they knew, the American intelligence knew who was helping you?
Yes. Well, because our intelligence then could also help the French in some ways or other. So anyway, he kind of shifted around and I got the idea that I was supposed to leave, and he says, well, Lieutenant, is there anything I can do for you while you're still here? Because he said, I know you're only going to be here for a few days. I liked that, and I kind of smiled, and I said, well, you could promote me to a captain. If you flew 5 missions, you immediately became a first lieutenant. So I'm a first lieutenant, and I said, hoping you could promote me to a captain, because once I get back to the U.S., there'll be no promotion. He kind of smiled. He said, well, it's been very interesting visiting with you. Thank you for taking the time to come to see me. I said, well, it's been my pleasure. I'm sorry I couldn't tell you more, but that's the way it is. So I'm in Breckenridge, Minnesota, in early March, and I get an envelope in the mail.
1944?
1944. I get promoted to captain. So I went from being a second lieutenant to a first lieutenant to a captain in a year and about 2 months. And I go around to some of these military bases now and talk to these guys that have been 4 and 5 and 6 years waiting to get a promotion. I said, well, do you want me to make you feel bad? Oh, sure, what's the matter? I said, there's nothing the matter with me, but I can make you feel real bad if you want me. Dog, go ahead. They'd sit there and shake their head. There's another, you know. You can beat the system.
So you think that happened a lot in World War II?
I don't think it ever happened. I don't think anybody would have intestinal fortitude enough to go up to their commanding. This man is a full colonel, and he's in charge of the whole air base. And he's brand new. That's why he wanted to talk to me. He wanted to get a... He was brand new to England. My guess would be that there was never another evader that ran into a brand new group commander. And if there was, he wouldn't have intestinal fortitude enough to ask to be promoted. So I was pretty big.
You're smiling.
Well, I am. Didn't happen to a lot of people.
Probably did not.
I never would have been promoted to captain if I was stateside. My poor old co-pilot, he went all through the military 4.5 some years as a second lieutenant. C'est la guerre.